So imagine waking up from like a hangover so severe, so physically and spiritually crushing that you genuinely fear you're going to die right then and there.
Oh man, just that absolute rock bottom feeling.
Right, exactly. But then by the end of that exact same afternoon, you aren't just fighting a headache anymore. You're actually strapped to a stretcher in a pitch black ambulance.
Bound by belts made entirely of human skin.
Yeah, being driven to the freezing edge of the world. Welcome to the deep dive, everyone. Today, you and I are stepping into what has to be one of the most disorienting pieces of short fiction you will probably ever encounter.
It really is. It's a Finnish excerpt titled Leteri Teksti.
Which translates to attached text, right?
Exactly. And it centers on this protagonist named Toivo. And you know, our mission for this deep dive is to really tear apart the mechanics of narrative whiplash.
Because it just completely violently drags you as a
Oh,
reader.
totally. You go from the gritty, grounded realism of like a raw addiction memoir, and then it blasts you upward into this moment of miraculous spiritual awakening.
And then just instantly drops you into visceral, supernatural horror.
Right. And that concept of narrative whiplash is so crucial here because usually a story gives you subtle cues. You know, it lets you acclimate to the rules of the universe.
Yeah, it eases you in.
But this text is the exact opposite. It builds a very specific, grounded reality just so it can completely shatter it right in front of you.
Which is terrifying. But before we really get into the mechanics of how this text operates, I think we need to establish a very clear framework for you, the listener.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Because this excerpt relies heavily on extremely polarized religious and supernatural concepts. I mean, we're going to encounter direct invocations of Jesus, literal demonic entities, and prayer acting as an almost kinetic physical force.
Right, and our objective today isn't to validate or debate those theological concepts. We aren't looking to prove or disprove the existence of grace or demons or anything like that.
No, not at all. We're looking at the architecture of the nightmare itself.
Precisely. We are analyzing these spiritual forces strictly as literary devices. We want to understand how they function within the machinery of this incredibly gripping story.
How they serve Toivo's journey.
Exactly. And how they manipulate your expectations as a reader from one sentence to the very next.
Well, let's jump right into the opening scene then, because it establishes this baseline of pure, unadulterated physical misery.
It's so visceral.
It really is.
Yeah.
We find Toivo waking up in an apartment that is just choked with stale smoke. His head is absolutely throbbing.
And he drags himself upright.
Right. And the very first physical sensation the author gives us before we even get a visual layout of the room is auditory and tactile.
Which is such a specific choice.
Yeah, Toivo takes a step, and there's this loud, metallic crunch of empty cans beneath his feet.
It really assaults the senses immediately. The author doesn't start with Toivo's thoughts or his emotional state. We start with the physical environment.
And that environment is just suffocating.
Totally suffocating. The crunching cans, the lingering smoke, it creates an incredibly claustrophobic atmosphere right off the bat.
It grounds you in it.
Right. The sensory details are engineered to make you feel the grime and the sickness. It anchors the narrative in this grim, unmistakable reality of severe addiction.
It's incredibly effective. And I mean, it doesn't stop at the auditory stuff either. He notices a wine glass left on the table. He picks it up, tastes it, and the text simply says it was truly awful.
Oh, yeah.
He literally gags. So we have the throbbing pain, the metallic crunch, the stale smoke, and the gag-inducing taste of leftover alcohol.
Just a complete sensory overload of decay.
You know, reading this, the only analogy that made sense to me was that feeling in a survival video game when you only have one hit point left.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Like the screen is flashing red, your character's moving sluggishly, and the environment itself feels actively hostile.
Everything is a threat.
Exactly. The air in this apartment is poison, the floor is an obstacle course of trash, and the only available sustenance makes him sick. His health bar is practically empty.
I like that framing because it really highlights the vulnerability of the character. When you are down to one hit point, any sudden movement, any minor threat can be fatal.
And Toivo is acutely aware of this.
Very aware. While he's standing there, holding his throbbing head in this decaying room, he starts trying to piece together fragments of what he calls crazy dreams from the night before.
And this is where the text starts playing games with us, I think, because the dream fragments he remembers are so utterly disconnected from the room he is standing in.
The contrast is jarring.
Right. He remembers green stones. He remembers a guardian angel. He remembers getting married.
Yeah.
And then looking at the contrast between those dreams and his reality, he thinks to himself, and I quote, "At this rate, I'll die before I'm 30.
Think about the psychological tension being constructed in that single paragraph. Look at the stark divide between his physical reality and his mental space.
It's massive.
It is. The physical space is dirt, decay, isolation, and pain. It literally pulls him downward into the floorboards. But the mental space, the dream fragments, are these shimmering, almost mystical images.
Like the green stones.
Right. Green stones suggest rarity or spiritual value. An angel suggests divine protection. Marriage suggests union, commitment, and a future.
The exact opposite of his current life.
Exactly. They represent the antithesis of his isolated, decaying reality. The author is establishing a fundamental tension between the bleak dirt of his waking life and this unseen, almost taunting spiritual dimension.
I have to challenge the nature of those dreams, though.
Okay, what do you mean?
Because as a reader, you immediately start trying to solve the puzzle, right? You ask yourself, are these dream fragments, like the green stones and the angel, actually psychic premonitions?
Ah, I see where you're going.
Like, are they foreshadowing the bizarre supernatural events that are about to hit him? Or, and I think this is a highly valid reading, are they just the literal misfirings of a brain drowning in alcohol poisoning?
It's a fair question.
Is the author writing magic realism or just a clinically accurate depiction of withdrawal hallucinations?
Well, I think the ambiguity is the point.
Yeah.
The narrative wants you sitting in that uncomfortable space, unsure of what is real.
Just off balance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But whether the dreams are a mystical foreshadowing or just neurological misfires, they serve the exact same narrative function. They highlight his desperation.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And that desperation is anchored by that incredibly bleak, ticking clock thought, "I'll die before I'm 30.
Such a heavy line.
It really is. That single sentence does a massive amount of heavy lifting. It instantly establishes the stakes for the entire story. Toivo isn't just a guy having a rough Sunday morning.
He's on the brink.
He is a man standing with his toes over the edge of a cliff. He is completely lucidly aware of his own mortality and the terminal trajectory of his self-destruction.
And it's that exact realization of impending doom that serves as the engine for the plot, right?
Absolutely.
Because if he was just mildly hungover, he'd probably drink a glass of water and go back to sleep. But that panic, that acute awareness that his time is literally running out, is what physically forces him out of the apartment.
It is the catalyst.
Yeah, he knows he has to move. He has to reach out for a lifeline, even if his version of a lifeline is incredibly twisted, which leads us into how he tries to escape that room.
Right. He doesn't call a doctor or a family member.
Oh, no. He calls his friend Mike.
And here we enter a deeply liminal space in the narrative. Toivo needs to break out of the claustrophobia of the apartment, so he reaches for the only connection his current lifestyle allows.
And the text gives us a very specific, almost eerie detail here. It says the phone rang for a long time before Mike finally answered.
Which builds so much tension.
It does. And when Mike does pick up, Toivo doesn't ask for help. He doesn't say, "Mike, I'm terrified. I think I'm dying." He just says, "Let's go drink at the Riverside Park."
Yeah.
His proposed solution to the poison is to go find more poison.
Which is, sadly, a tragic but highly realistic portrayal of how severe addiction operates.
Because the only cure for the withdrawal is the substance itself.
Right. But let's look at the mechanics of this transition. Toivo throws on a torn denim jacket and stumbles down the stairs of his apartment building.
That jacket feels important.
It is. That jacket isn't just a wardrobe choice. It's a physical manifestation of his fractured, broken state. He is literally wearing his vulnerability.
And when he gets downstairs, Mike is already there in a car blasting music.
Right.
This sequence of events is where I really start to feel the ground shifting beneath Toivo's feet. Because Mike says this incredibly specific, weirdly poetic thing.
Oh, about the song.
Yeah. He says, "Toivo, I found a good song. It talks about a river. Hop in and let's go."
We really need to dissect the motif of the river here, because it operates on multiple frequencies in the story.
What do you mean by multiple frequencies?
Well, on a purely literal geographic level, it is a destination. It's a place in the city where two guys can go drink in the morning without being bothered, right?
Yeah, sure, just a practical notation.
But structurally and symbolically, rivers are ancient, heavy literary devices. They represent transition, the relentless flow of time, cleansing, And most critically, they represent boundaries between worlds.
Like crossing over into the unknown.
Exactly. You look at mythology, the river Styx, the river Lethe. Crossing a river means leaving one state of existence and entering another entirely.
I hear the mythology argument for sure, but I want to push back on applying that too heavily right off the bat.
Oh, why is that?
Well, isn't it just as likely that a riverside park is simply a gritty, realistic setting for two addicts to hide out? Like, are we giving Mike too much credit by assuming his song choice is this massive mythological bridge?
That's a fair skepticism,
mm-hmm.
but I think the text forces us to look closer at the sheer coincidence of it.
The timing of the song.
Right. The author deliberately points out that Mike's song talks about a river, mm-hmm. matching Toivo's exact suggested destination before they even get there. The song acts as a thematic soundtrack, narrating Toivo's life in real time.
That's a good point.
Whether Mike knows it or not, the narrative is using him to signal that a boundary is about to be crossed.
That actually ties perfectly into what I find so unsettling about this car ride. Think about the timeline for a second.
Walk me through it.
So Toivo makes a desperate, panic-driven call. The phone rings for an uncomfortably long time, which dilates time and builds this weird, isolating tension.
Right.
Then he stumbles downstairs and the car's already there, doors unlocked, blasting music about the exact location he just named.
It is very fast.
Yeah, I feel like the mundane, gritty realism of The Hangover is starting to crack here. It doesn't feel like a casual hangout anymore. It feels orchestrated.
You were suggesting a loss of agency on Toivo's part.
Exactly. It's as if the environment itself, the song, the destination, the perfectly timed arrival of the car, is setting the stage for something massive.
It's very predetermined.
It has this dreamlike, predetermined atmosphere. It's almost as if the universe or some unseen force is hijacking his bender.
I love that phrase.
Right. The reality of the text is warping before they even put the car in drive. The car is acting like a transition pod, taking him from the physical decay of the apartment into a completely different genre of existence.
Hijacking the bender is a fantastic way to phrase it, honestly. Because the mundane details are aligning too perfectly, suggesting a higher or at least a different order of reality is bleeding into his world.
And he's just along for the ride.
Exactly. And your instinct is entirely correct, because once they step out of that car and arrive at this symbolic river, the gritty realism shatters completely, and we experience the first massive tonal whiplash of the story.
Which brings us to the Riverside Park itself. And when I say Toivo experiences a salvation here, I mean it happens with an overwhelming, almost violent velocity.
The narrative pacing accelerates dramatically right here.
Right. So Toivo is sitting on a bench at the park. He is looking inward, taking stock of his life, and he notes that he is feeling completely empty, depressing, and dark.
Just a void.
His life is just a void. He is at absolute rock bottom. And right at that exact second of total internal darkness, he looks up and sees three people approaching.
Out of nowhere.
Yeah. And the text says he literally saw the joy and peace shining from their faces. He immediately feels this deep, cutting jealousy. He just wishes he could possess whatever it is that is making them glow like that.
The contrast the author paints here is absolute.
Yeah.
Total, consuming internal darkness, meaning literal shining external light.
And the interaction moves incredibly fast.
It really does.
They walk right up to him and ask, out of nowhere, have you heard about Jesus? Toivo has a brief internal monologue where he notes that he has prayed a little in the past.
He's not totally unfamiliar with the concept.
Right. They ask to pray for him right then and there. He agrees, noting that he senses their sincerity and, quote, the presence of some spirit.
And then they drop the big question.
Exactly. They ask, do you want to give your life to Jesus Christ?
Pay close attention to the physiological reactions that follow that question.
Yeah, because he says, yes, I do. And the very millisecond he speaks those words, he feels a sudden, sharp prick in his heart.
Just instant physical feedback.
He collapses to his knees. He completely breaks down crying. The strangers place their hands on him and pray in the name and blood of Jesus.
Wow.
And Toivo describes experiencing something like a massive power descending upon him straight from heaven, filling his chest with a feeling of total, absolute freedom.
We really have to analyze the mechanics of this transformation because it completely defies how we usually understand human psychology and recovery.
Oh, absolutely.
Think about how addiction is normally treated in literature. It's a long, arduous journey. It involves therapy, relapses, slow rehabilitation, and agonizing physical withdrawal.
It's a marathon.
Right. But this text throws all of that out the window. It treats spiritual salvation not as a gradual psychological process, but as a sudden physical impact.
It reads like a kinetic strike.
Highly kinetic. Look at the verbs and the bodily sensations the author chooses. A crick in the heart, falling to his knees, breaking down, a power descending.
Those are violent actions.
They are violent, overwhelming forces acting upon his physical form. It is as if grace isn't a state of mind, but a tangible weight that drops onto him from the sky, overriding his nervous system.
And the text punctuates this physical overwhelming with an incredible atmospheric detail.
Oh, the lightning.
Yeah. Right after the prayer finishes, he looks out over the river and sees something like heat lightning brighten the sky.
That is such a specific image.
That specific image, heat lightning, struck me as so profound. You know, heat lightning is a meteorological phenomenon where you see the flash of lightning illuminating clouds, but the storm is too far away to hear the thunder.
Right. It's silent.
It's silent, distant, but undeniable light.
How do you read that in relation to Toivo's internal state?
Well, it feels like a direct analogy for what just happened inside his brain. It's like he has been wandering through this suffocating, dense fog of addiction and depression where he can't see 2 feet in front of him.
Right.
And then a localized weather event, this silent spiritual lightning strike, instantly burns the fog away. He sees the light even if he doesn't fully comprehend the storm that caused it.
And the aftermath of that lightning strike is presented as an absolute miraculous cure.
It really is. He stands up from his knees. He is hugging these complete strangers. He says he feels completely liberated, as light as a feather.
And then the author drops a line that completely rewrites the reality of the story.
The line about the alcohol.
Yes. Toivo says, "It was a funny thing I realized. I didn't crave alcohol anymore." Just like that.
It's just gone.
Gone. The existential dread, the severe physical dependency that had him stepping on crunching cans and gagging on stale wine just hours before, it is entirely evaporated.
And this is where you, as the listener, are forced to interrogate the text.
You really have to.
Because this happens so incredibly fast, we have to ask what kind of reality we are dealing with. Does the narrative want us to view this as a genuine, objective, divine intervention occurring within the physical world of the story?
Right.
Or are we witnessing a massive psychological break? Is Toivo a man so entirely desperate, standing so close to the edge of death, that his mind has constructed an instantaneous hallucinatory savior to protect his ego from the reality of his own terminal collapse?
Yeah, it's a very grounded way to look at it.
I am leaning heavily toward the psychological break theory, honestly. The idea of the quick fix is such a dangerous psychological trap for addicts.
You just want the pain to stop instantly.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want the long road of recovery. You want a magic wand. So when he hits absolute rock bottom on that park bench, isn't it entirely plausible that his brain simply snaps and manufactures this euphoric, light as a feather delusion to shield him from the pain?
It is a highly plausible psychological reading.
Mm-hmm.
But the brilliance and the cruelty of the author is that the text refuses to let you sit back and analyze that question.
It really doesn't give you a second to breathe.
It doesn't give you a moment to debate theology or neurochemistry. Because the exact second he achieves this profound peace, the exact moment he feels light as a feather, the universe of the story violently snaps back to punish him for it.
And when it snaps, it is brutal, which violently throws us into the next phase of the story. The genre tracks completely vanish, and we plummet straight into supernatural horror.
The transition here is engineered to cause maximum reader disorientation.
Literally, the sentence, after he realizes his craving for alcohol is gone, the text hits us with this. Suddenly, a large gang appeared in front of me and surrounded me.
Just instantly.
There is no buildup. There's no sound of footsteps crunching on gravel. They don't walk over from across the park. They just materialize.
That's very cinematic in the worst way.
Right. And Toivo, who is still riding this incredible, euphoric high of absolute grace, looks at this menacing gang of strangers and he says the most vulnerable, naive thing possible.
He's totally defenseless.
Armed with his new faith, and he looks at them and says, "Jesus loves you."
And that single sentence, "Jesus loves you," is the trigger. It is the hinge on which the entire narrative turns from a story about spiritual redemption into a story of absolute carnage.
Because the gang's reaction is terrifying. They don't just mock him or tell him to shut up.
No, the text says a demonic cackling laughter bursts from their mouths.
They instantly tackle him to the ground, and they begin kicking him in the face with such extreme targeted violence that one of his eyes literally bursts.
Which is just a horrific visual.
It's awful. He is left howling in absolute agony on the dirt, his eye destroyed, bleeding out, and amidst all this screaming and violence, he hears one of his attackers scream out.
But the author explicitly notes, it is not a normal shout.
Right. It is a demonic shout. And the attacker yells, an ambulance for Toivo.
The tonal shift here is almost physically jarring to read. In the span of maybe three sentences, we go from a miraculous feather-light salvation to grotesque, mutilating physical violence.
Total whiplash.
And what is vital to understand is that this assault is entirely unprovoked by anything mundane. It is a direct, immediate reaction to his declaration of love and faith.
His newfound purity is the exact thing that draws the violence.
Correct. The text is very explicit about the nature of this gang. It doesn't say they sounded like demons as a metaphor for their cruelty.
It's literal.
It calls their laughter and their shouting explicitly demonic. This moves the threat entirely. We are no longer dealing with the mundane danger of a street gang or a mugging. We have entered the realm of active spiritual warfare.
The stakes just skyrocketed.
They did. And the specific type of violence they inflict, the bursting of the eye, is highly symbolic and deeply intentional by the author.
It is so visceral. I honestly flinched reading that detail. Why the eye? Why not just beat him up generally?
Because it is a direct attack on his perception. Think about what an eye represents in literature and mythology.
Vision, clarity.
Right. Perspective. Illumination. The light. Toivo just had his eyes open to the beauty of the world, to salvation, peace, and his own potential. He finally saw a way out of the dark.
So they blind him.
So the very first thing the darkness does when it attacks is violently steal that vision away. It is a physical defilement of his newly cleansed body. By bursting his eye, they are literally and metaphorically plunging him back into the dark.
That makes the narrative pacing feel deeply, almost sadistically cruel to the protagonist.
It is very cruel.
Think about how unfair this universe is. He literally just got saved. He had maybe 2 minutes of peace. He felt light as a feather for a handful of seconds.
Barely time to process it.
It's as if the sheer act of declaring his salvation, of vibrating at a higher spiritual frequency, painted a massive supernatural target on his back. I want you to think about how jarring that is. What does it say about the rules of this universe, that an act of pure grace is immediately, almost instantaneously, answered by an act of extreme targeted malice?
It's like the universe cannot tolerate his happiness. It suggests a universe that is in a state of active, aggressive war over his soul. The light swoops in and claims him in an instant, and the darkness instantly counterattacks to drag him back down.
A zero-sum game.
But that brings us to the most bizarre, anomalous detail of the entire scene. A detail that really forces us to rethink what is actually happening. The demonic attacker calling for an ambulance.
Yes, an ambulance for Toivo. I tripped over that line.
It stands out so much.
Why on earth would a demonic entity who just kicked a man's eye out of his skull for mentioning Jesus care about getting him medical attention?
Because it completely subverts our understanding of what an ambulance represents.
How so?
Well, in our world, an ambulance is a vehicle of rescue. It is a safe haven. It is a promise of healing and professional care. By having a demonic entity call for one, the author is signaling that the violence on the street wasn't meant to be fatal.
It was tactical.
Exactly. They didn't want to kill him there. They needed to incapacitate him so they could transport him. They were capturing him. The ambulance isn't coming to save him. It is the vehicle designated for his transition to the next phase of his nightmare.
That realization shifts the whole tone again. It is no longer just a gritty story about a street assault. And it's not even just a chaotic, supernatural skirmish.
It's much worse.
It implies pure, systematic horror. He has been kidnapped. The chaos was just a distraction to bag him. And that horrifying realization brings us to the final, chilling segment of our deep dive.
The conclusion is so dark.
This section is attributed to Topi Halt 2 in the source text, and it is a complete descent into absolute, inescapable madness.
The sensory details in this final section are incredibly rich, deeply horrific, and they serve to completely undo everything Toivo experienced at the river. Let's examine exactly what he wakes up to.
It is the ultimate nightmare scenario. He wakes up inside an ambulance, but it isn't white, it isn't red, it isn't brightly lit, it is a black ambulance.
A hearse, essentially.
Basically. And he is bound tightly to a stretcher, but he isn't strapped in with nylon webbing or standard medical restraints. The text explicitly says he is bound by belts made of human skin.
Right there. In that one horrific detail, any lingering illusion that this is a real medical vehicle is obliterated.
Completely gone.
Human skin bolts imply a level of sadistic harvesting. This is an environment of pure systemic decay and corruption. The loss of bodily autonomy is absolute. He is strapped down by the remains of others.
And the horror just compounds. Standing over him is a figure the text literally calls a nurse from hell.
Such a chilling phrase.
She is wearing a dirty white suit. When she grimaces down at him, Toivo can see her bleeding gums. Wow. She is holding a needle and thread, and she uses it to sew his burst eye shut.
It's agonizing to even think about.
While she's performing this horrific procedure, she is gnashing her teeth and taunting him, drawing out his name in this mocking sing-song voice. Toivu, Toivu.
We need to look at how the author is actively inverting medical imagery here to maximize the psychological horror.
Like twisting symbols of safety.
Exactly. Everything in an ambulance mm-hmm. that is supposed to be sterile, safe, and healing is presented as filthy and harmful. The white suit, a symbol of cleanliness, is dirty. The bleeding gums suggest profound disease and rot rather than health.
And the needle and thread.
Right. The act of sewing up a wound, which is fundamentally a restorative, healing action, is presented as an agonizing act of torture.
Because she isn't fixing him.
Exactly. By sewing the burst eye shut, she isn't repairing his vision. She is sealing his blindness permanently. She is literally locking him in the dark.
It is like an inverted nightmare version of a rescue op. Instead of paramedics rushing in to save his life and bring him back to the light, he has been scooped up by a supernatural extraction team that is dragging him straight down to the underworld.
That's a perfect description.
And the taunting of his name that really got under my skin, Toivu, Toivu. It is worth noting, if you dig into the linguistic context, the name Toivo actually translates to hope in Finnish.
Which is such a massive detail.
The author named the character Hope. So when she is dragging out the vowels, sounding like a bully on a playground, she isn't just mocking a man. They are mocking the very concept of hope.
That is so bleak.
They are laughing at the idea that he ever thought he could escape.
They are reveling in his absolute vulnerability. And then the text delivers its final, terrifying image, sealing Toivo's fate.
The driver?
Yes. The driver of this black ambulance turns around. He is wearing a black tuxedo, which is funeral attire, not medical gear.
Right, adding to that hearse imagery.
He has pitch black eyes, mm-hmm. and he speaks through a rusty mesh that separates the cab from the back of the ambulance.
And he has this incredibly deep voice, and he says the final words Toivo hears before he completely loses consciousness. Code 6 to Vladivostok.
The weight of that final sentence is immense. We have to extrapolate on the metaphorical significance of that specific destination.
Vladivostok. It's yeah. a real place, right? Why not just say to hell?
It is a real place. It is a major city in Russia, located in the extreme far east, bordering China and North Korea.
Okay, so very remote.
Extremely remote. But in a literary and historical context, Vladivostok has long been associated with the concept of exile. It is the terminus of the Trans-Siberian Railway. It represents the absolute end of the line, the freezing distant edge of the known world.
So it's not just a city.
No, to be sent to Vladivostok in this narrative context isn't just about changing geography. It is about being cast into the deepest, coldest, most isolated exile imaginable.
It is the absolute furthest point away from the warmth, the light, and the heat lightning of that riverside park.
Exactly.
And combining that desolate destination with the phrase Code 6 is what truly terrifies me. Code 6 sounds like police jargon. It sounds like a dispatch code for a taxi or a delivery service.
It implies a system.
Precisely. It implies a bureaucratic element, this demonic kidnapping. This wasn't a random act of street violence. This is an organized, systematic harvesting of a human soul.
That's the scariest part.
The forces of darkness in this story aren't just chaotic monsters. They have their own protocols, their own dispatchers, their own dark hospitals located at the freezing edge of the world. They process souls like paperwork.
So, to summarize where this incredibly dark journey ends up, this final image completely and utterly shatters the brief victory Toivo had at the riverside.
Just shatters it to pieces.
He found total euphoric freedom for maybe 60 seconds, and now he is strapped down with the skin of dead men, his eye has been sewn shut by a diseased nurse, and he is being driven into permanent bureaucratic exile by a demon in a funeral suit. He is left in total darkness, both literally and figuratively.
The narrative whiplash is complete. The author has successfully dragged the reader from the mundane, visible despair of a hangover up to the euphoric, almost blinding heights of spiritual salvation, and finally down into the deepest, most inescapable abyss of supernatural horror.
And they did it in an incredibly compressed amount of text, constantly pulling the rug out from under your expectations.
It's exhausting, but in the most fascinating way, it forces the reader to constantly readjust their footing. You think you are reading a memoir, then you think you are reading a religious parable, and then the final sentence locks you into a horror nightmare from which you cannot wake up.
It's a masterclass in tension.
It really is. But as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final lingering thought. Something to mull over that twists this entire narrative one last time.
Well, I like where this is going.
Given exactly how this text begins, with Toivo waking up in a suffocating room, his head throbbing from a massive bender, gagging on stale wine, questioning his own fragmented, crazy dreams, and explicitly fearing that he will die before he turns 30, we have to ask ourselves a very dark question.
Which is?
Did Toivo ever actually leave that smoke-filled apartment?
Oh, wow.
Is the ringing phone, the perfectly timed car ride with Mike, the shining strangers at the riverside, the miraculous heat lightning, the demonic gang, the burst eye, and the dark ambulance to Vladivostok? Is all of this just the final terrifying sequence of hallucinations of a dying mind?
That changes everything.
Are we simply witnessing a man lying on the floor of his filthy apartment, his brain chemistry completely collapsing, succumbing to the very fate he feared in the opening paragraph? Is the supernatural extraction team just his brain's way of interpreting his own biological death?
That is incredibly bleak, but it fits perfectly.
Think about that the next time you wake up from a dream you just can't quite shake. The kind of dream where the architecture of reality feels just a little too fragile. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the absolute extremes of narrative whiplash.
Keep questioning the reality of the stories you encounter.
Look for the mechanics beneath the magic, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.